to the A-News podcast. This is episode 133. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org. Editorial, Hope versus Horror. Bear with me a moment as I come at this week orthogonally. I just played this game. Maybe there will be another editorial in which I rant about what is called an RPG these days, but here let us just acknowledge that there is no way I recognize this game as an RPG and move on. It's a pretty and extremely linear game, more an illustrated story, about a teenager going to help her dying grandfather in a location where a meteor hit and mutated a bunch of people and plants and shapes. It's about conflict between people and also people's relationship to land. The player plants gardens that benefit an important tree and enable a variety of positive effects. It made me think about the Hopi belief, and maybe others, but I heard about it from the Hopi, that humans are here to take care of the land. And of course, for A-News readers, this comes up when there's a story like the one on the Amazon burning, in which so many of the comments that I relate to most are challenging the capacity of humans to save the world. What is the difference between helping and saving? What happens when we can't imagine a good role for ourselves in the world, when we can only see ourselves as some aberration with no appropriate place in the system we're in, much less the one we want? By this premise, we can't even call ourselves parasites, since parasites play valuable roles in ecosystems. I think that kind of lack of a role, achievable or not, leads to a kind of horror that is not better than the empty hopefulness that is maybe its mirror image. What is the space outside of either hope or horror? And is there any way to talk about it using words, especially words in English? The game used music a lot. I don't know, made me think. What's new this week? 3 months of insurrection from CrimeThink, a follow-up to CrimeThink's interview from June with members of an anarchist collective in Hong Kong. Though slightly jargon-heavy, a gomben, this is an extremely enlightening piece on the events in Hong Kong since June from actual living anarchists that doesn't rely on that most reviled creature, the journalist. Quote, "Everything leads us to believe that we continue to live in mythical times. How else can we explain the continual appeals to the courtiers of the international community, utilizing the international mass media as a tribunal through which we hope to gain an audience with the emperor, i.e. the United States? There remains the faith that at a higher court of appeal, the criminality of the rogue states that govern us can be brought to justice and punished in the name of elemental, natural rights that have been violated in the full light of day. Somewhere we believe, even if only in the hearts of decent, right-thinking people everywhere, there is a sense of solidarity with this primordial and transcendent law, and justice will be done, justice will descend from the skies," unquote.
Anarchist gangs for metropolitan disruption claim attack on Zagreifu police. From Anarchists Worldwide, a communique about an incendiary attack on a police station. Quote, "We must make a strong and sharp presence in the battles to come. Only through action can we show what we want, and we want it all, now, and for everybody. We send our solidarity to imprisoned comrades Dino Gyekzoglu, Yanis Dimitrakis, and Kostas Sakis, as well as to the Park Bench 3 in Germany. We do not forget those who have fallen in the social war, nor do we forget the murders of Pavlos Fisas and Zach Kostopoulos / Zaki O," unquote.
Exarchia anarchists surprise riot police reoccupy squat. From Anon. A report back from an action and a communique of a protest for a squat evicted in August of this year. Quote, "Instead, they chose to celebrate the anniversary like the evacuation never happened by organizing a collective dinner on Exarchia Square to celebrate the squat's birthday with their one and only weapon, solidarity, as noted in their public communique. During the event, people decided to defy the militarized law imposed on Exarchia, and while taking the riot police brigades by surprise, managed to enter the building, which had been sealed with bricks, symbolically reoccupying it. They hung a huge banner that said No Passeron, lit up flares, and shot fireworks, while more activists protested in the street in front of the building. They then exited the building the same way they entered, unnoticed, leaving the riot police on the spot astounded, who then had to bring a crane to enter the building from the balconies in a big operation, remaining puzzled, trying to figure out what has just happened," unquote.
Anarchist prisoner Peralta on hunger strike following final hearing. from It's Going Down. Peralto is from the El Ocho Chitlan de Flores Magón in Oaxaca, Mexico. On October 26, 2018, Miguel was sentenced to 50 years in prison on charges of homicide and attempted homicide, charges often fabricated against community organizers. Quote, "Once again, I am using my body as a weapon of struggle against injustice. Beginning today, beyond my silent strike, I will stop consuming food. Hunger strike menu. My breakfast, a snack of patience. My lunch, a buffet of resistance. My main course, solidarity. My dessert, freedom." Unquote. According to a story on the site Voices in Movement, Peralta is now being denied normal visiting hours as punishment for this hunger strike.
Statement by Marcelo Villarreal from Act for Freedom Now via IMW English. A statement from a Chilean prisoner briefly stating a history of recent actions in Chile. Villarreal was sentenced for illicit terrorist association, damage to a cop car with serious injuries, co-author murder qualified as terrorist, theft with intimidation, and explosive attack against the Spanish embassy. Quote, "The way of seeing and understanding the conflict changed forever, and the theoretical tools of the armed left were assumed as a living reflection of an endogenous inability to rethink the road. All of us who continue without vacations or temporary withdrawals at the time understood the need to build from horizontality, from affinity, attacking the state and capital, building culture for social warfare through the daily life in the collective, in the band of music, publishing books and fanzines, in the squatter, in the library, in the high school and university, as individuals exploited, promoting the revolt, and not as square militants of closed organizations fighting fictitious wars. Likewise, since the end of the 90s, we found ourselves with Peñis, Mapuches, rebuilding their nation from a real autonomy in a war of liberation that up to today remains alive and strong as the blood that sustains us." Unquote. One wonders what terrorist association is not illicit.
Face to face with the enemy, Severino Di Giovanni from AMW English via finimondo.org. This post is the fiery and challenging introduction to a new book in Italian on Severino Di Giovanni, who also has a biography in English through Elephant Editions called Anarchism and Violence. Di Giovanni is another icon of action and dedication, and a call to a different and active anarchism. Quote, "If they used the expression autonomous anarchism, it was to emphasize their independence with respect to trade union organizations, including those of a libertarian tendency, or to organizations of synthesis, including anarchist ones. If they called themselves anarchist expropriators, it was to mark their own difference from those who subordinated their activities to the requirements of the penal code. They tended towards quality in everything they did. The struggle for ideas as a song of life. For them, anarchism was also beauty, joy, sensitivity, company of accomplices, generosity, courage. In other words, the rise to a climax. Not for nothing can we find in the pages of Culmine or Anarchy, newspapers edited by Severino and his comrades, not only invitations to action, claims of attacks, articles of agitation and social analysis, but also poems, literary extracts, historical texts, and philosophical variations on free love and artistic reviews. Because when life burns, it wants to devour everything. He says yes to all possibilities, proudly affirms the individual will." Unquote. Basically this whole introduction speaks to me. Could be worth finding out who wrote the intro and reading more of their stuff if they write in English or if you read Italian. And every biography from Elephant Editions is inspirational.
What is Burning the Amazon? From CrimeThink. Another topical story from CrimeThink that arguably accepts too much of the mainstream media framing. An article I read this week talked about how climate change is a huge and gnarly issue, but that it's not actually the problem, that it's a symptom getting treated like a cause. There's a sound argument that by addressing climate change, which, while huge, is still somewhat conceptually manageable for people who aren't, like us, ready to rip this modern world to pieces with our teeth, but it also risks, like all reforms, the danger of misdirecting people's most significant efforts and imaginings. Anyway, this piece by CrimeThink mostly sticks with the horror story that is the situation in Brazil at the moment and calls the bigger problem capitalism, which I find short-sighted and unfortunate. Quote, "Both left and right governments see nature and human life chiefly as resources with which to produce commodities and profit. The government of Bolsonaro, a declared enemy of the common people, women, and indigenous groups, doesn't just threaten us with the physical violence of police repression. In declaring that he will no longer recognize any indigenous land, Bolsonaro is intensifying a war on the ecosystems that make human life possible, a war that long precedes him. Unquote. That first line starts right, but then isn't it interesting how they go from saying all government is bad to complaining about Bolsonaro? Maybe interesting isn't the word.
Paul Goodman's Anarchism Has Meaning Today, from Anarchismo by Wayne Price. This is a solid assessment of Goodman's thought, at least as far as I can tell, both strengths and weaknesses, the latter being mostly a lack of insight into the role of reform in a capitalist system. Quote, there is no overall system of Goodmanism, unlike Bookchin's efforts to create a total worldview. But central to Goodman's thinking was what he called the anarchist principle. This was a belief grounded in historical evidence, but also in humanistic faith. He thought that people working in a face-to-face community could solve problems with which they were directly in touch. They performed better without threats, coercion, external bosses, extrinsic rewards, top-down direction, and preset agendas, unquote. This is my favorite piece by Wayne so far. Thanks, Wayne!
Anarchists march in Poznan in defense of Rozbroj arrest by ANA. From A Infos, this is a very brief announcement that the Rozbroj squat in Poznan, Poland, is under attack, apparently by gentrification and maybe some arrests, and people are defending this 25-year-old social center, gym, cultural space, and residence. There's also a few minutes of Polish video of the protest. So many black and red flags. And then a really big black and red flag. Good luck to Rozbroj and all anarchist squats.
Report back from youth-led anarchist bloc at hashtag climate strike from It's Going Down. A first-person account of squirrely liberals, black bloc, and white supremacist provocation. Sounds like most protests I've been to, if a bit bigger than some. Quote, as the bloc spread out and through the crowd, things became more chaotic. We split up into ones and twos and threes, going about various self-appointed tasks as we advanced towards the front, and our ultimate task of getting past a thin and scattered line of reporters and police standing between us and the Hawthorne Bridge. Our bloc merged with another, larger one at the front, this one notably young, composed mostly of blocked-up teens. Their youth and their banners immediately identified them to me as the PNWYLF. I had been impressed by their coordination and courage at the last action and was elated to march with them. That same aging hippie, or perhaps one who looked just like her, appeared again, this time telling us not to get to the front because we wanted no reporters to get pictures of people with masks on amongst the protest. She went so far as to grab at me over this, jerking my arm. I slipped out of her feeble grasp, and we marched onwards. Merging quickly into a scattering and reforming column, we punched through the line, the group's youthful bravado bearing us past the stunned and outnumbered police officers. We were like self-willed water flowing up the slope of that bridge, unquote. Yeah, a bit too self-congratulatory, but okay, adrenaline is fun.
Audio and video. Building self-defense against electronic surveillance. 52 minutes from It's Going Down. This is an interview with an employee of the Electronic Frontier Foundation who at one point says they're an anarchist, but also believes that radical action can curb, quote, unethical electioneering, unquote. Most of what's talked about is super bare-bones privacy practices, but even that ends up being too superficial to be useful. Double sigh.
Final Straw, the OVIS Speak on Living and Fighting in LA, an hour from the Final Straw Radio. Episode starts out with the ever-inspiring Sean Swain laying out his plan to swap politicians. Rest of the episode is an interview with three organizers from La Concha, which is, quote, an anarchist space in the Boyle Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles that does many projects such as prisoner solidarity, legal and popular education, reading groups, bike brigades, and lots else, unquote. La Concha was the recent site of an attempted disruption by Maoists that ended in the commies pepper spraying three people. The interview touches on the history of the three members interviewed, the organizing principles of La Concha, and much more.
Anarchy Bang, introducing episode 38, Group Logic, Pro and Con. 2 hours. Quote, we'd like to hear from you, either live during the show or by email beforehand, on your experience with anarchist groups. When have they done a great job of whatever your goal was? And when have they done a crummy job? We desperately need to be in physical space with each other, but rarely do our groups do what we aspire to. How can we improve our groups? Do we make them more open to new people and new ideas? Or do we make them more rigorous, think federations and their ideal of coherence and focus? If we were to discuss examples, it would be about scale. Do we create anarchist groups to put on events or to take on the world? Event-based groups seem very small in the scale of the things we'd like to accomplish. Why have we become so humble? Have we become less ambitious, or has the world humbled us? If you were going to fix anarchist groups, would you aspire to bigger projects or a more disciplined cadre? Would you make anarchism great again, or just aspire to do more interesting things? Unquote.
Topic of the week, history and how we tell it. I was reading the introduction to 7 Years Buried Alive and Other Writings, and this quote on history stuck out to me. With each exciting and ultimately tragic narrative, we learn once more that anarchism is a thing of the past. Without meaning to, our erstwhile attempts to rescue any inspiring history for ourselves have the opposite effect. There is more than sarcasm in the accusation one sometimes overhears that some anarchists of today are nostalgic for the capitalism of the late 19th century or the states of the time before world and cold wars militarized all social space. Our sad comrades have so burdened themselves with the anarchist history, fragmented and incomplete though it may be, that it seems they think better in 100-year-old terms and theories than in anything of the present, let alone the future. They present to us dueling concepts of history, one that weakens and one that strengthens. There's no shortage of examples of how anarchists can be weakened by stories of the past, both the now distant past, as described in the quote, and even more recent events. My own coming into anarchism happened among the dying embers of the global justice movement that had as its high watermark the shutdown of the 1999 World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle, something at which, at least in the U.S. context, it continued to yearn for and emulate over the following decade to little effect. So too with personal narratives, achievements never to be lived up to, failed activism that becomes the death of all activity, which can leave us paralyzed or locked in an activist treadmill. What are some narratives, personal or grand, that anarchists tell themselves about the past? How do they weaken or strengthen us? How do you tell a story about the past that strengthens rather than weakens, and how much of that is on the storyteller versus the audience? Aragorn?
Well, this is a huge question, obviously. I mean, I think that I turn this into a conversation about storytelling because the question itself is so huge. In other words, it's sort of, you know, why are anarchists doomed in 100 words or less? That's not a great question to ask. The idea about how anarchism is a human phenomenon today, that to me is an interesting question that somewhat relates to this. To what extent do we blame the audience for how shitty our stories are right now? That's another sort of question. The idea that in this era where Trump and the alt-right and activism has returned to the streets, but basically isn't fighting for anything that's real or meaningful. Like, these are all parts of the same question, because this question is huge, again. But I do love the question on the level of the paragraph that sort of talks about this person's this person's history.
Uh-huh.
That's the right question. Meaning, you know, what's changed in that period? Like if this person came of age watching the anti-globalization movement on TV, and then tried to participate as fast as they possibly could, and then what happens 20 years later? Like, right. That's a great question, because it's talking about this 20-year arc,
right?
But the fact is that, you know, we're not going to get that back. That's not going to happen again in our lifetime.
Sure.
And, you know, then when we look at the victories and losses that have happened since 2015, and framing things in terms of sort of good and evil, alt-right and you know, the rest of us, like these are the narratives that anarchists tell themselves about the past. Like, this narrative that in 99 there was this incredible thing that happened. Mm-hmm. The number of people that were self-described anarchists at that event in 1999 was a fraction.
Very small.
Very small number of people. Even compared to the number of self-described anarchists that were involved in fighting the alt-right. But I guess there's a way in which I think at this point we have too many storytellers and not enough story. Meaning that, like, the rise of how much anarchist media there is right now sort of means that we spend a lot more time fighting with each other over what the story really is, rather than letting it breathe a little bit. You know, like since 2015, there have been a preponderance of people who are devoting their energy to storytelling around fighting the alt-right, rather than analyzing what victories and losses have had, or perhaps just sitting in it a little bit, you know, like doing a little bit more living, a little less writing. Anyways, it's like, you know, I'm very interested in this question of storytelling, but I don't trust a lot of the people who are in such a hurry to tell stories. And perhaps this is just me sort of finding a way to criticize IGD because they're so in a hurry to own the story and to sort of be the propagandists of record or whatever. But perhaps propaganda and that process of propagandizing is different than the process of storytelling, which does seem to have to breathe a little bit more. I guess those are my initial thoughts.
My initial thoughts are much more in line with the history question. It was notable to me that when I came into anarchy and was being taught about this is what anarchy is, that it was a huge, huge history lesson.
Right, but that was a history lesson that basically wasn't of the time that you were in. But was
no.
It was of 68 and earlier.
68, the Spanish Civil War, mm-hmm. Sacco and Vanzetti, like those three particular time periods. I mean, to be fair, one of the incredibly influential people in my life was someone who was a history nerd. That mm-hmm. was his thing. but I was coming out of the second wave feminist movement, which was steeped in history, but spoke of everything now and current events, and everything was very alive. And of course, you have to do that when you're trying to wage political campaigns. But while anarchy was interesting and intriguing, it also felt like I was too late.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. It was history. It wasn't alive. Yeah.
It wasn't so alive. And the anarchists that, like, the funnest thing I did with the anarchists I knew was have a regular potluck and read books and talk about books, which was perfectly fine for me. But those don't become the stories that you tell 100 years later. I'm an anarchist. I'm going to own this. This is important to me. I want to be a part of this. I want to be an active agent in it. So then I started thinking about how do we reclaim it and make it feel like it's alive? And at the time, the NEFACers were still kind of relevant or someone to reckon with, or like, you know, if you were anywhere in the eastern half of the country, you kind of had to deal with them. And so like they were kind of my nemesis. But just personal, just me, sure. Not because they'd done anything to me or anything like that. But it's like, because to me, they represented everything that was wrong because they had steeped their entire politics in a 100-year-old document and building from there, which they weren't. And all of that was insane to me. Mm-hmm. So how did I be the opposite of NEFAC?
Right.
And of course, I remember 99 and remember how striking it was, and then remember everything else trying to be it afterwards and failing pretty quickly, almost immediately. It's like the tactics, the things that it had played out, they kind of never got the chance to play out again.
Sure.
If I recall correctly. Maybe once, but that would be it at the most.
There were quite a few events that emulated the Seattle model all the way to 9/11. And then that DC event that happened a week or two after 9/11, mm-hmm. that sort of represented the end of that period of time, in my opinion.
But no, I don't mean that model. I mean the actual, I'm going to be really generous here, the tactics that they pulled off that actually did manage to kind of befuddle the police and make people feel like they were in a position of power and they were kind of owning the streets, like that part of that phenomenon, that felt like a one-time thing. Like they surprised them. The protesters surprised the cops. They pulled it off. It was amazing. But you know, then the surprise was done and they never got to do it again.
If we were joined on mics by an old-time crime thinker, they would talk about almost every event that happened in that period of time had a moment.
Okay. All right.
That felt amazing and felt like
that's fine.
The logic of statism and capitalism.
Sure. Then I'm not here to say that's not true.
Yeah.
Now I don't remember where I was going, but this topic, especially the way that it's phrased, especially the quote, it resonates with me. Mm-hmm. But I also kind of, I feel like I have stumbled into the answer to the question by being a part of a project that then becomes a part of the dialogue of the politic. But I'm not sure that's it. I'm not sure I'm done. But I don't know what the next thing is.
Well, it's good to hear that you're not done. I mean, I do think that you've absolutely answered the question there in this last stanza. You know, what are some narratives that anarchists tell themselves about the past? I think that the way in which the platform, i.e. the platform from 1918 written by Machno and company, the fact that that was still part of the anarchist discourse in 1999 or a little after, like that's a big deal. Like that tells us a lot about how some people frame anarchism. They frame it entirely as this sort of like a history of noble people who had really good ideas and who that are still relevant today would be, just to put it really closed off. But, you know, then there's why the confusion?
No confusion. Please go on.
Okay. How do you tell a story about the past that strengthens rather than weakens, and how much of that is on the storyteller versus the audience? You know, this is one of what I consider to be my biggest problems with anarchism, which is how much anarchism considers itself to be a story about the past.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the most important thing about whatever the anarchism that I've been participated in, but also that I would like to continue to participate in for the next 20 to 40 years of my life, is not about a story of the past, but a story of the future. You know, I still see anarchism as an open-ended vision that we can contribute to articulating and to making real. But, you know, that's because I basically am not overly in love with anarchism of the past.
I will say that in response to how do you tell a story about this path that strengthens rather than weakens, I have been in a room a few times with what I'm going to consider the best historical anarchist storyteller. I don't know if anybody knows who he is anymore because he's kind of checked out of the scene, but his name's Barry Pateman.
Sure.
And he would tell stories about 80-year-old schisms between people that you'd never heard of, and you were entertained and went through a fuller range of emotions and walked out feeling inspired and bigger than you were when you walked in.
For sure.
And better and as if this thing that you were doing is
important
and part of this rich lineage. Yep. And you have all this to draw on. And I saw him give a talk. Each talk was different, I think 3 times. And every single time I walked out feeling that way.
Yeah.
And could it be the particular stories he chose? Maybe, but I think it's a lot more the storyteller than it is the story. And there's definitely a lot to be said for that. And which I will lean on the last part of the question, how much of that is on the storyteller versus the audience. Everyone went in with an understanding of what they were going to get, and there was an agreement, and they walked out happy. You know, he walked out happy with what he'd given. The audience walked out thrilled with what they received. Sure. And you felt like you had a relationship with them when it was over. And I think that that was probably an important part of it. And I haven't seen anything like it since then. I don't feel like.
Yeah, I mean, he probably is the most entertaining, at the very least, anarchist historian alive.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's probably also just becomes a part of that is about the depth of his knowledge and all the things that he can reach for when he's telling the story, all the little nuggets he can pull out. So, yeah, hats off. Hope that you're well, Barry.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, this podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and Greg and read by Chisel and Greg. Editorial by Chisel. We thank Aragorn and a friend for their help on the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackcart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, see you at anarchistnews.org.